Aloha kākou, velina kākou, greetings everyone. My name is Dr. Kehaolani Kawanui, and I'm your host on Indigenous Politics from Native, New England, and Beyond. This program features the political and cultural struggles of Native American and other Indigenous peoples. On today's show, we will be featuring three different presentations recently made at the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association Conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota. This will include a joint presentation made by Amy Denouden and Ruth Garbi Torres called Altered State, Recognition, Native Rights, and the Maneuvering of Indian Policy in Connecticut, as well as a presentation by Jean O'Brien called State Recognition and Termination in 19th Century New England. I'll tell you more about the presenters and the context in which they presented their work shortly, but first I want to let listeners know that this show is produced in the studios of WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, also known as Mattabesset, the traditional homeland of the Wangunk Indian tribe. This show is also heard on select Pacifica affiliate stations, including WNJR in Washington, Pennsylvania, WETXLP, the independent voice of Appalachia, which broadcasts throughout the Tri-Cities region of East Tennessee, Southwest Virginia, and Northwest North Carolina, WBCRLP in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and WORT in Madison, Wisconsin. From wherever you are listening, I can receive emails with your feedback on the program. The address is indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. Again, the address is indigenouspolitics@wesufm.org. And for those wanting to catch up on past episodes, check out the program archives online at indigenouspolitics.com. Now to tell you more about the program today. As I mentioned, the three presenters who you will hear from, Denouden, Torres, and O'Brien, presented their work at the first Native American and Indigenous Studies Association conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota, held on May 21st through the 23rd. The Native American and Indigenous Studies Association, also known as NISA, developed from two meetings. The first was held at the University of Oklahoma in Norman in May 2007, and the second at the Institute of Native American Studies at the University of Georgia in April 2008. At the 2008 meeting, registered attendees voted to ratify a constitution and bylaws for the new association. Attendance at both meetings was so much higher than expected that it was clear that an annual meeting to harness the collective energy of the field was in order. The members of the founding steering committee of the NISA were Jean O'Brien, Robert Warrior, Inez Hernandez Avila, K. Chanina Lomawaima, Jace Weaver, and myself. The first NISA conference in Minneapolis drew more than 600 scholars from 16 countries and dozens of tribal nations to exchange research ideas and give each other professional support. The 2000 meeting also included the introduction of officers elected in NISA's first election. These officers of the new council include NISA President Robert Warrior, President-elect Jean O'Brien, Secretary Maggie Walter, Treasurer Brendan Hokofitu, and regular council members Lisa Brooks, Rob Innes, Chris Anderson, Alice Tepunga Somerville, Noinoi Silva, and myself. This is a really exciting development. And it's also, I should mention, a very diverse first-elected council, including members who are Maori, Native Hawaiian, Indigenous to Tasmania, Australia, Abenaki, Métis, Osage, Ojibwe, and Cowessess First Nation. For any of you that want to learn more about the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association, you can go to www.nisa.org. And again, the acronym for the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association is NISA, N-A-I-S-A. Again, the website is www.naisa.org. Now, it was at that conference that the panel that these presentations I'm playing for you today come from. The panel was titled Tribal Recognition, Reacknowledgement, Unacknowledgement, and Termination, State and Federal Policy on Trial. I will first play you the joint presentation made by Amy Denouden and Ruth Garbi Torres, followed by Jean O'Brien's presentation. So let me give you some introductions to Amy Denouden and Ruth Garbi Torres, and I'll play their presentations back to back, and then I'll come back to introduce Jean O'Brien before you hear her presentation. Amy Denouden is an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. For over a decade, she worked as a researcher and consultant for the federal acknowledgement projects of the Eastern Pequot Nation and the Golden Hill Paugusset Nation. At UMass Boston, she's worked with students and members of local Native communities to launch the university's Native American Student Society in 2003 and developed an ongoing series of Native American educational and cultural events, including lectures by Native American scholars, activists, and educators. Her recent publications include her book, Beyond Conquest, Native Peoples and the Struggle for History in New England. And I want to make sure listeners know I've interviewed Amy Denauden on this program about that book, and if you go to the program archives, you can look for that interview by clicking on Season Number 3, Show Number 4. After you hear Denauden's presentation, you'll hear from Ruth Garbi Torres, and they collaborated on this presentation together. And now to introduce Ruth Garbi Torres. She is a citizen of the Shkatakoke Tribal Nation and a lifelong resident of Connecticut. She is a formal tribal counselor and treasurer and served on the Shkatakoke Tribal Nation's Constitution Revision Committee. She was also a participant in the executive session on American Indian constitutional reform held at Harvard Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University. For 20 years, she has served as a Connecticut State employee with the Department of Public Safety. She also serves as a member of the advisory board of the Native American Cultural Center at Yale University.
I just want to begin by thanking Ruth Garbi Torres for working with me on this project. And we've just had a great time together talking about this issue and having a chance to vent about the Attorney General in the state of Connecticut, who fancies himself a modern-day Indian fighter, I guess, right? I think that the first important question to ask about Connecticut's contemporary Indian policy is, where is it? Is it located in a particular text or set of texts? Is it to be discerned from something that might be termed popular opinion? Does it have an official spokesperson whose public commentaries flesh out a governmental position on Indian affairs? For those of us who have worked on indigenous rights issues in Connecticut over the past few decades, particularly as they're bound up in federal acknowledgement struggles, we'll be quick to respond to the latter question and point to the office of the state attorney general, Richard Blumenthal, who has for over a decade made himself this, the Somebody central voice of Connecticut Indian policy, particularly on the matter of what is, commonly called tribal recognition. In our abstract for this paper, Ruth and I point to what we call recognition talk as the crucial discursive realm of the state's Indian policy in the late 20th century, purposely phrasing it as such to evoke its multivocal, malleable, and, of course, its contestable nature. That is to say, recognition talk includes what we might call loose talk, rumor and slander, a lot of that in, among non-Native folks in Connecticut, especially on the matter of indigenous identities in the state. And as I've argued elsewhere, Connecticut is really a core site of the production of the racialized notion of the Indian imposter. And this idea emerged in the 18th century. And of course, it's proved to be an ingenious silencer of indigenous rights issues. But recognition talk also includes official governmental pronouncements, and one of the places you can go to find those is the website of our Attorney General, who has a long list of self-congratulatory press releases on the issue of federal acknowledgement in Connecticut. And here's one of them. This is a classic. I'll let you read it as we go along here. But notice that one of his a common refrain from the Attorney General of the State of Connecticut has been that he's interested in fairness in the process. This is the leitmotif of his long running commentary on a federal acknowledgement. So from his position, if there's a positive proposed finding or a positive finding, it's evidence that the process is unfair. If there's a negative finding on federal acknowledgement, it means the process works. So he's got a very effective logic working for himself there. When I look at these kinds of statements on the Attorney General's position on federal acknowledgement, I think about the complexity of deconstructing it for students, for university students who, don't have much of a background in, the history of the formation of colonial and Euro-American Indian policy. And so, also discussing Indian policy, especially in New England now, southern New England, to an audience, a university audience that will likely be largely non-Native, presents, considerable pedagogical and political problems, particularly since, and Bruce Dutu has pointed this out very nicely in his recent volume, American Indians and the Law. Federal acknowledgement, now tends to be lumped into that category, now called special rights, right? And from the perspective of non-Native folks, primarily Euro-American folks in southern New England, what are called special rights are unfair in a purportedly democratic system. But, there's other kinds of loose talk with respect to recognition in Connecticut, too. A town official in southeastern Connecticut, in response to the positive proposed finding on the Eastern Pequot federal acknowledgement, said, that a federal acknowledgement is balkanizing the United States. So one has to, counter that to college students. And getting students to start to think beyond this special rights notion takes quite a lot of sustained historical study. Especially, in southern New England, where Indian issues now, what's called Indian issues, and this is when you go to the Attorney General's website, you'll see that, one of his subcategories is Indian issues. In Connecticut especially, Indian issues equals casinos issues, and this is a logic that's incomplete and politically ineffective for anti-Indian racism without reducing the issue of tribal recognition to the sole means to an economic end of casino dollars. And, this strategically blind calculation incites that what is now the quintessential Euro-American special rights question, or, I think it's really a racial fantasy question of the day, which is, and I've heard this in some of my classrooms, quote, why can't I have a casino in my backyard? Or the related declaration, I'm going to get some of my friends together so we can petition for federal acknowledgement and have a casino in our backyard. This is an important example of recognition talk as rumor, but it's also connected to the broader discourse of Indian policy, or to bring Foucault into this with the regime of truth of Indian policy in New England, and it deflects our attention from the fact that these federal acknowledgement petitions, as many people who have worked on petitions know, are really a documentation of the history of a people. And this was dramatically displayed in Connecticut, and I think it was 2005 at that forum on federal acknowledgement at the Connecticut Historical Society, when about a dozen members of the Scaticoke Tribal Nation walked up to the podium where the Attorney General was standing with stacks of documents about 2 feet high and placed them at his feet. That was one of the few moments where the Attorney General didn't look like he was too sure about how he would respond to that. So all of this that I'm saying by way of introduction to what Ruth will go on to say is leading to the point I want to make about arguing that Indian policy has to be interrogated in two interconnected ways, and one of course is as a racial discourse. And so when we think about it as a racial discourse, we see that it has a genealogy. And this is, and it's a colonial genealogy, of course. And this is an important way to get students to think beyond this. They'll often be very quick to say, well, the problem with this is that it's biased. Bias is not, if only that were the problem, that it were that simple, it's weeding out bias. It's certainly not. So if we think about Indian policy as a racial discourse, and we think about, we go back to, for instance, Vine Deloria's masterpiece essay, The Red and the Black, from 1969, which really, was the first thing that I read that got me thinking about, the connection between Indian policy as a racial discourse, the formation of racial thought about Indianness as connected to limiting land rights, and Deloria fleshes that out beautifully. But, of course, so does Robert Williams in his wonderful book, Like a Loaded Weapon. So, Connecticut Indian policy has its own racialized lexicon, its own code, if you will, by which it constructs and manipulates ideas about Indianness and Indian rights, and by which it also makes certain claims of, and this is very important for us to understand, those of us who work on federal acknowledgement in this area, makes certain claims about history and law, and meshing them and confounding them, and urging its audience, to assume that you can read history off of law, off of statutes, off of policy. And this was, demonstrated in some of the responses, for instance, by opponents to the Eastern Pequot federal recognition positive proposed finding. Some of the comments from officials in the towns in southeastern Connecticut who had coalesced to fight their federal acknowledgement. And in the comment period after they got their proposed positive finding, the towns argued that because the 1638 Treaty of Hartford said that the Pequots were conquered and no longer existed as a nation, they no longer existed as a nation. So this was actually argued and submitted to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So this is, you know, a kind of ideological nonsense that that we have to deal with. And then I want to just quickly, before Ruth comes up, just to say that the other way we need to look at Indian policy is as a form of governmentality. And here is where, you know, we need to bring in some of the critical analysis of the anthropology of colonialism. So, you know, and as a form of governmentality, that doesn't just mean that, it's a part of the colonial technology of population control, but that it's a means by which, governments authorize themselves. You know, and so when you think about Indian policy, especially in Connecticut, as a way that the state authorizes its own authority, you can then, look at what is happening now with respect to official governmental pronouncements on reservation land in Connecticut. The manipulations now of what the state had clearly acknowledged as state recognition of these Native American nations. Now this is an idea that's being manipulated. Recently, the governor of the state of Connecticut stood before a Senate committee, it was 2005, I think, and said, there are no historical reservation lands in Connecticut. They're now, cities and towns and neighborhoods. Strikingly, to bring the 18th century into this, this is precisely the kind of approach taken by the governor of the colony of Connecticut in 1736 in opposition to the Mohegan Land case. The Mohegan Land case was seen as being just profoundly disruptive to the colony. It would essentially overthrow the colony. Mohegans who came in 1736 to and other members of other Native communities to testify before a 1736 commission appointed by the English Crown to hear the case were denied the right to speak. And so, there are some striking similarities between what happened in that period and now. But I think we need to look carefully at how state officials will manipulate this idea of state recognition, which was used, of course, to undermine the Eastern Pequot's federal acknowledgement petition. So understanding Indian policy, I think, from these two approaches, especially in Connecticut today, is very important for us. Thanks.
And again, that was Amy Den Ouden, and now we transition to Ruth Garbi Torres' presentation. They did a joint piece together.
Thank you. So this is part two. It's been said that you can't understand law if you don't understand history. I believe that this statement can be applied to public policy as well, at least in the area of Indian affairs. If you don't know the history of tribal-state relations, you may never understand why Connecticut Indian Affairs policies have been inconsistent, shifting, manipulated, and even absent. I suggest the status of Indian tribes, in addition to the biases Amy discussed, dictate Indian policy. This is not to suggest the tribes or Indian citizens themselves do not affect policy. The historical record reflects periods in time when policy changes would not have been implemented were it not for the actions of the state's indigenous population. However, whether colony or state, ally or opponent, Connecticut clearly has the final say on the policy agenda, formulation, decision-making, and implementation processes that embody its own policies. Early history of Connecticut Indian policy is not particularly different from the other British colonies and fledgling states. In the beginning, the tribes were acknowledged as sovereigns, completely separate and outside the scope of both colonial and early state government. This relationship, sovereign to sovereign, is the foundation for the widely accepted government-to-government relationships that exist between the many tribes and other governments in the United States today. The tribes were also valuable trading partners to the English. Maintaining policies to secure peace and cooperation were in the best interest of commerce. Although the English should not consider the Indian people as social peers, they needed the resources belonging to or provided by the natives and adopted somewhat equitable trade policies as the English-Indian relationship developed. The Pequot Massacre proved to be a turning point in tribal relations and colonial policy, with the Pequots first to be affected by this change in Connecticut. In exchange for their lives, the surviving Pequots were awarded to the colonists' Indian allies in 1637, and as Amy alluded to, they were forbidden to regroup themselves as Pequots, so they didn't exist. Additionally, the colonists and their Indian allies agreed that the Connecticut colonial government would arbitrate all future intertribal conflicts. The English were starting to view Connecticut's Indians as conquered and assumed a hierarchical role in their affairs and in governance particularly. As a result of this attitude change and fear of an Indian uprising, the English passed laws that prohibited Indians from handling English weapons and forbade them from entering colonial homes. It was policies such as these that reinforced English feelings of superiority. During the next 22 years, some of the tribes sold or traded land to English settlers. Disputes, as you would imagine, arose as the settlers took more Indian land than bargained for, stole land not negotiated, and allowed farm animals to graze among the natives' corn plantings. During this time in history, the English viewed the Indians as an impediment to settlement and still as inferior to English people. This attitude resulted in policies where justice often favored the English. In fact, in 1657, as a result of a land dispute, the English set aside what was probably North America's first reservation. Of particular interest, and a reflection of how the English saw the Indians at that time, the Pagussets, the affected nation, were not even allowed representation at the hearing that settled this land dispute. The Connecticut General Assembly was formed in 1661 and the official state entity which handled Indian affairs. The early General Assembly acted as both legislature and judiciary. Indian policies of the day were incorporated in the laws produced through both functions. The General Assembly made Pequot law, for example, by appointing Pequot governors. Some of the laws governed drunkenness and Sabbath profaning. The birth of the reservation system and the self-appointed authority to make laws governing Indians clearly marks the start of Connecticut policies that eroded tribal sovereignty, made wards out of Indians, and contained elements of colonial paternalism. These policies perpetuated for almost 300 years until major policy shifts in the 1970s. One important policy of the early Connecticut government was settlement expansion. As mentioned earlier, this often resulted in land disputes. A colonial example of how the policy of inaction still results in desirable policy outcomes is when the Connecticut government simply ignores the pleas of the Indians. Back then, the Pequots lost land to English encroachment in the mid-18th century, appealed to the General Assembly for redress, and Connecticut finally heard their dispute 5 years after the original petition. By that time, of course, the settlers had already established their homes and their crops, and cultural bias helped to mold policy, too. The English considered Indians lazy, and as a result, the ethnocentric General Assembly decided the Indians weren't using the land, so the colonists had more of a right to it. In effect, land grabbing became an acceptable practice to implement the policy of expansion. The Indians were constrained by the colonial government, and this remained unchanged when Connecticut became a state. Indians siding with the colonists during the American Revolution apparently did nothing to influence this outcome. By the time Connecticut became a state, the policy of protection was well established. The colony of Connecticut once appointed overseers for the Indians, now the state appointed the overseers. The state assumed the role of Indian guardian, arguably not doing an adequate job of it. Reservation life created dependence out of the tribes. Reservation land was generally not the land that English could work. It was not tillable and often was rocky, hilly, such as the land at Scaticook. This was a setup for failure. Bad land, limited hunting, reduced game, and unfettered encroachment created dependency and poverty among the native people, and with the reservation system came a complete shift in state policy. The land, rather than the native people, was often what directed the state's interest in Indians. The overseer system was eventually died after 274 years, and in 1935, the State Parks and Forest Department took over Indian affairs, and that's how the state expressed their interest in the land rather than in the people on the land. The government then believed that it would be best for Indians and everyone else if the Indians would more or less stop being Indians and become part of the dominant society. Private land ownership was one cornerstone for implementing the federal policy of the day, and this was the period when, in the federal world, the allotment process was taking place. Not surprisingly, Connecticut seems to have been mirroring the federal government's policies at the time. Although I didn't find any evidence that Connecticut wanted to eliminate the reservations, my research was limited for this, and I do believe that based on some of the communications between individual tribal members at the time in the 30s and 40s, the Parks Department did see the reservations as future parks. Indian Affairs in 1941 was transferred to what was then called the Welfare Department in the state, and that was a continuation, let's say, of how the state viewed the Indians as wards. During that time, we saw none of what was really innovative policy at the federal level, with Roosevelt trying to implement some of the Indian self-government tools at the federal level. Up until, let's see, during this time, under the Welfare Department as well, we're talking the 40s to the 60s, the Welfare Department refused to maintain reservation homes. They were allowed to fall into disrepair. And on my own reservation, in the 1960s, the Volunteer Fire Department was given permission to go onto the reservation and burn the homes and extinguish the flames for training purposes. The Civil Rights Movement marked the next phase of Connecticut Indian policy. By the 60s, only a few families lived on the reservations throughout the state, and a small group of Scaticokes found support in the General Assembly that would propose legislation to remove Indian Affairs from the Welfare Department and give Indians a little more influence over their own affairs. Eventually, and I'll wind this up here, a Connecticut Indian Affairs Council was put in place. The council, not surprisingly, was placed under the jurisdiction of the Department of Environmental Protection because there was no more parks and forests. And again, this confusion or conflict between the land and the people is what continues to drive the policy in the state of Connecticut. Amy alluded to Governor Rell's testimony before the Senate Oversight Hearing on Tribal Recognition in 2005. And her statement exactly, she had two statements that I think show the confusion at the state level of what they don't even know what their policy is. One of her statements was that we recognize and embrace our historical heritage, and we have courteous, mutually respectful relations with the Mohegan and Mashantucket Pequot tribal nations, both of which are located within the borders of our state. And while Indian families are still living on the state reservations, Governor Rell unbelievably denied the existence of state tribes and probably showed her ignorance of state Indian affairs and Connecticut history by saying, historical reservation lands no longer exist as such and haven't for well more than 200 years. So I would just close by saying that one of my friends, Dr. B, who was a, Dr. Robert B, an anthropologist and advisor to the Carter administration, said to me that after I told him I think that the policies of the state have been widely inconsistent, he said, contrary, he says, I would argue that the Indian Affairs policy of Connecticut has been consistent, consistently self-serving for the non-native power brokers. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was Ruth Garby Torres. And now to hear Jean O'Brien. She is an enrolled member of White Earth Reservation, Mississippi Band, Minnesota Chippewa Tribe. She is an associate professor in the Department of History at the University of Minnesota, where she specializes in American Indian history and United States colonial history. Besides over two dozen articles, she is the author of a book titled Dispossession by Degrees, Indian Land and Identity in Natick, Massachusetts, 1650 to 1790, published by Cambridge University Press in 1997, and reissued in paperback by the University of Nebraska Press in 2003. Her next book is due for release in spring 2010 and is titled Firsting and Lasting, Writing Indians Out of Existence in New England, to be published by the University of Minnesota Press. Some of you may have also seen her on the PBS American Experience recently, titled We Shall Remain, since she served on the advisory board. Here's Jean M. O'Brien's presentation.
Thank you all for being here. I'm so excited. This is really amazing. It's kind of weird being up here because I like teach in this room and others much like it all the time. And usually there's a podium here and there's not. So I hope I'm going to be able to read this paper. And it's going to be 20 minutes. Sorry. It just is. In the last half of the 19th century, actually this paper I think fits really well with yours. Both of the ones we've heard already, and probably the fourth one. These papers just kind of came together as individual submissions. It's really incredible. In the last half of the 19th century, the state legislatures of Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island took measures that purported officially to terminate the ongoing legal recognition of Indian people still present in their own homelands, echoing the gesture Connecticut had made to legislate the Pequot out of existence in the wake of the Pequot War in 1637. These actions and others paralleled a mythology that New Englanders had been haphazardly forging in cultural prediction throughout the 19th century, that Indian peoples in New England had ceased to exist as such. Indeed, these forces interacted with notions about racial purity and blood, importantly influencing debates over the status of Indian communities. This self-serving process amounted to an abandonment of the trust responsibility implicit in the notion of guardianship as it had organically developed in New England, and I want to argue it carried grave consequences for Indian people. Although the process transpired in various ways throughout New England and was linked to national struggles over race, slavery, citizenship, and equality, all of these movements towards terminating New England tribes were rooted in the failure of non-Indian New Englanders to recognize Indian peoples as Indians. The best evidence that this process was deeply flawed can be found in the still unfinished process of re-recognizing New England Indian peoples through the federal processes beginning in the 1970s. Thus, long before the U.S. Indian policy of the 1950s of terminating the federal relationship with tribes turned out to be a colossal case of wishful thinking, New Englanders embarked on an official state-level actions to legislate Indian peoples out of existence that were doomed to failure. Indeed, predictions of the vanishing Indian that can be dated at least as early as the now iconic Squanto, last of the Pawtuxet, are among the oldest and most stubborn tropes in Indian America that continue to be revealed as mythological. Even while non-Indians failed to understand the Indianness of still present Indian peoples, which translated in their failure to recognize Indian peoples as such, the states of Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island did indeed extend official recognition to tribes, which we've been hearing about. While the relationship between each state and tribe varied in particular details, parallels can be drawn among them and between these relationships and those that operated on the federal level. The situation in New England, and generally speaking other former English colonies, differed than elsewhere in the United States in that federal Indian policy as developed in the new nation did not specifically govern Indian affairs there. Nonetheless, state bureaucracies did exist that gave shape to Indian affairs in 19th century New England. These bureaucracies grew organically from colonial policies, and so straightforward and comprehensive blueprints for these relationships do not exist. Instead, the general shape of Indian policy and its bureaucracy can only be understood by taking into account the actual state of affairs in the periodic legislation that took up Indian relations from time to time. Indian affairs in this context often seem tremendously haphazard, as officials involved with tribes rarely concern themselves much with those tribes under their oversight on the one hand, and Indian peoples frequently sought to avoid that oversight on the other. Rhode Island created an Office of Commissioner of the Narragansett Indians in 1840, but neither Connecticut nor Massachusetts developed even this modicum of regularized bureaucracy governing Indian affairs. An 1859 report filed by John Milton Earle, appointed to investigate the condition of Indian peoples in Massachusetts, offers an excellent snapshot of Indian affairs that can be extrapolated across 19th century southern New England. I'm going to quote a little bit here. "There has been neither order, system, nor uniformity of purpose in our legislation concerning the Indians. The subject has not been studied, nor the facts ascertained, or the relations correctly understood by successive legislatures, and consequently much of the legislation has been special in its character and too often dictated by mere expediency for the occasion to get over present difficulty. And the whole matter has become so complicated that he must be a patient man who will trace out the legislation and digest it, and a wise one if he can tell when he has done it." Precisely what the legal relations of the Indians are and what their various rights in relation to property, whether it be held in sovereignty or in common, have reference to as well to the Indian traditional law as to the statutes of the Commonwealth, unquote. That's a mess, right? Although writing specifically about Massachusetts, Earle could equally have included Connecticut and Rhode Island in his assessment. Among his recommendations for rectifying the situation was the appointment of a single commissioner for Indian affairs in the Commonwealth so that some more comprehensive vision and understanding of the state of affairs might be achieved, a recommendation that was, of course, not implemented. So what were the constituent elements of the official state recognition? While the exceptions can be found to nearly everything I'm about to tell you, some fundamental points can be made. The relationship between the states and the tribes developed organically beginning in the 17th century and can be characterized as that of a guardian to a ward, a concept famously summarized by Chief Justice John Marshall's majority opinion in the landmark decision Wista v. Georgia in 1830. They gave shape to the federal definition of Indian affairs. based on colonial then state statutes, sometimes general and other times specific to tribes or even individual Indians, the state acted as a guardian over Indian peoples and their property. They held reservation lands and other resources that remained in Indian hands in trust, with a theoretical system of oversight that prohibited the state the sale of Indian lands and resources without the approval of official guardians or overseers appointed by the legislature. Indian lands and other resources held in common remained exempt from taxation. Furthermore, and specifically related to their tax-exempt status as wards of the state, Indians were not guaranteed citizenship in their localities, the state, or the United States. Although, as Earle found in his rather extensive investigations, some Indians in Massachusetts did indeed pay taxes and exercise the franchise, and such arrangements were highly individualized. In the case of the Deep Bottom Indians on Martha's Vineyard, he noted, quote, they have never been under guardianship and are not considered as entitled to the rights of citizenship, unquote. No New England state guaranteed Indians citizenship prior to the 1869 passage of the Massachusetts Indian Enfranchisement Act after more than two decades of agitation. Indeed, the state of Connecticut, always a bellwether for everything great, right, did not extend citizenship to any tribes except the Mohican and Niantic until 1973. Throughout southern New England, abolitionism and the mounting crisis of the Civil War precipitated debates over the status of Indian peoples, although these debates varied in their particulars from place to place. Earlier, in connection with the events that collectively composed the Mashpee Revolt, the activism of William Apus' media attention had, quote, forced Massachusetts to acknowledge that Christiantown, Chappaquiddick, Gayhead, Mashpee, and Herring Pond were five communities within the state, but not of it, subject to its laws, but having no part in their enactment, within the limits of the local municipalities, yet not subject to their jurisdiction, and holding real estate in their own right, yet not suffered to dispose of it except to each other, unquote. In Massachusetts, agitation over the status of Indian peoples began in earnest in 1849 and continued until the passage of the Massachusetts Enfranchisement Act in 1869. Within this 20-year span, the legislature commissioned several investigations, headed by men committed to abolition and the radical Republican agenda, on the status and situation of Indians in Massachusetts, all three of which, quote, were explicitly charged with determining when and how Indians could be made full citizens of the Commonwealth, unquote. After the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, legislatures voiced concerns over being in violation of federal statutes if they did not extend citizenship to Indians. This decades-long debate is the context for the John Milton Earle report that I quoted from earlier, which offered specific recommendations on the pace of enfranchisement, suggesting gradual actions in keeping with the particular situations in different communities rather than so incorporating all Indians immediately. As noted by Anne Marie Plain and Gregory Button, enfranchisement in Massachusetts bore remarkable similarities to the General Allotment Act of 1887, sponsored by Massachusetts Senator Henry Dawes, in removing Indian lands from press protection and rendering it a taxable resource as well as in its citizenship objectives. It echoes equally, I want to argue, with termination policy initiated in 1953 in its language of liberation that cloaked the real intent, that of ending the recognition of Indian nationhood in the definitive legislative action, which went further than policy as it unfolded under the Dawes Act. This language from the 1848 Byrd Report, another one of those reports, could equally have been entered into the congressional record in 1953. I quote, "The progress of civil and ecclesiastical liberality has released all but the Indian from the disabilities, disenfranchisement. The African, the Turk, the Japanese may enjoy in Massachusetts all privileges of American citizenship. The Indian alone, the descendant of monarchs, is the vassal in the land of his fathers," unquote. What is left unsaid here is the ending of the guardianship relationship that recognized the separate nationhood of Indian peoples in southern New England. It is important to note here that there's a distinction between the exterior recognition of Indian separateness and its actual existence. It's an important distinction. Responding to the Earle Report in 1862, the Massachusetts legislature passed an act concerning the Indians of Commonwealth, that's what it's called. The first provision addressed the legal status of Indians. I quote, "All Indians and descendants of Indians in this state are hereby placed on the same legal footing as other inhabitants of the Commonwealth, except such as are or have been supported in whole or in part by the state, and except those also residing in the Indian plantations of Chappaquiddick, Christiantown, Gayhead, Mashpee, Herring Pond, Fall River, and Dudley tribes, or those whose homes are still on one of the said plantations who are only temporarily absent," unquote. By this act, Massachusetts extended citizenship to nearly 400 Indians while continuing the guardianship relationship with the seven enumerated tribes whose membership totaled more than 1,000. By Earl's accounting procedures, that is. In effect, this terminated the official recognition of the Commonwealth of these Indian peoples. An additional provision made citizenship a possibility for any other Indian or person of color upon application to the town clerk where they resided and the paying of a poll tax, which would terminate their recognition as Indians. Additional alterations followed this legislation, such as, quoting from the Aquinna Federal Recognition Petition here, the imposition of district status on Gayhead, which augured profound changes for the community. By increasing the power of elected officials and denying women the right to vote, it disrupted the egalitarian traditions of Indians. It also established the groundwork for terminating their communal system of land tenure and by hastening the development of a system of codified laws and recorded deeds, unquote. Agitation for terminating the official recognition of Indians categorically excluded from the enfranchisement and continued after the passage of the 1862 Act. The House of Representatives appointed additional committees to, quote, study the feasibility of removing the civil and political disabilities under which they are placed and of merging them in the general community as citizens, unquote. Finally, the legislature passed the Enfranchisement Act in 1869, which purported to eliminate what then-Governor William Clayfin declared a political anomaly. He continued, "These persons are not Indians in any sense of the word. It is doubtful there is a full-blooded Indian in the state. A majority of them have more or less the marked characteristics of the Aboriginal race, but there are many without a drop of Indian blood in their veins. The marriage of a foreigner with a member of a tribe transforms the foreigner into an Indian. The result of this singular system has been a heterogeneous population in which the characteristics of the white and Negro races have already nearly obliterated all traces of the Indian." And quote, here you have the legal calculus at work. Steeped in the 19th century language of blood, this declaration brought together the mythology of blood with the political project of termination, justifying the ending of the status, the trust status, by trucking in racist assumptions about Indians. Not surprisingly, enfranchisement and the duties and liabilities that accompanied the change in legal status engendered controversy and rancorous dispute within Indian communities. Earl reported opposition to the change in every community where he was inquiring, Chappaquiddick, Christiantown, Gayhead, Mashpee, and he himself opposed the changes in those communities as well as Herring Pond. At Chappaquiddick, the, quote, older members of the tribe, thoughtful, considerate, and prudent persons, believed it would operate disastrously on the tribe, that most of them would soon become the prey of the shrewder and sharper men outside, that the little property that they possessed would be wrested from them, unquote. Very prescient. At Gayhead, wrangling over land and the status of the community had begun early in the century and continued through the enfranchisement struggles. At Chappaquiddick and Christiantown, the land loss that followed the ending of legal protections fractured the communities and they moved to Gayhead or elsewhere. The administration of Indian affairs in Connecticut unfolded equally organically, and discussion about citizenship may have also been precipitated by events of the Civil War. Connecticut terminated its guardianship of the Mohegan in 1872, apparently at the request of the tribe, and they extended them citizenship and removed restrictions on land allotments that had been made to individuals in 1861. According to tribal historian Melissa Jane Fawcett, Mohicans requested this alteration in response to the corruption of their overseers, who allowed, quote, desecrations and theft of tribal land, unquote, to undermine the people. Connecticut later acted similarly to terminate the Niantic. No other Connecticut tribes were terminated in the 19th century. State recognition of the tribes has extended continuously into the present, making this all even more complicated, right? But interestingly, the issue of termination resurfaced in 1953 when a bill was introduced into Congress, quote, to end the second-class citizenship of Connecticut's few remaining Indians, unquote, specifically the Eastern Pequot. The bill's language, quoting from the Eastern Pequot Federal Recognition Petition, quote, was identical to the language of the 1872 Mohegan Bill, unquote. The effort failed. Debate over the status of Connecticut's Indians continued until the 1973 legislation that created the Connecticut Indian Affairs Council, which, quote, granted all the rights and privileges afforded by law that all of Connecticut's citizens enjoy. It further recognized that the Indians have certain special rights to tribal lands as may have been granted to them in the past by treaty or other agreement, unquote. The issue of reconciling rights also provided the pretext for addressing the situation of the Narragansett in Rhode Island in the Civil War era, although termination there received a public hearing as early as 1832. there in 1866, the legislature appointed a committee to look into the possibility of terminating the guardianship relationship of the state to the tribe and liquidating their lands on the premise that the state was, quote, not bound to extend the members of the tribe any particular or special privileges not enjoyed by all the inhabitants of the state, unquote, in spite of the long history of treaty relations inaugurated in the colonial period that protected tribal jurisdiction over their lands that they acknowledged. The committee met with the tribe and, quote, sundry citizens of Charlestown, unquote, during which they informed the assembled group that equality before the law, without regard to race or color, had culminated in the Civil Rights Amendments. This prompted a concern on the part of the legislature and citizens of the state, quote, that this tribe, to whose ancestors our ancestors were under so many obligations, should still claim to owe allegiance to their tribe rather than the state, and to maintain even a semblance of another jurisdiction among us, unquote. Furthermore, they opined, no one should be part of a privileged class in the state. But the committee had approached the tribe in order to hear the view of others, including the officers and members of the Narragansett tribe. The Narragansetts obliged. According to the newspaper account of the gathering, they delivered their reply with dignity of propriety of manner, informing the committee that they had not initiated the meeting and, as far as they knew, were living in peace and prosperity, thus calling into question the purpose of the entire affair. They continued by taking up the idea of citizenship, informing the committee that they had traveled the country and, quote, heard much said about the rights of the Negro, of Negro citizenship and Negro equality, but we have not found the place where this equality and these rights exist or the Negroes who enjoy them, unquote. Astutely pointing out the failure of the law to guarantee African Americans equality, Narragansetts rejected the possibility that the law could similarly ensure their rights. Furthermore, and this is, I think, just an amazing quote, and it's a bit lengthy, so bear with me. We are not Negroes. We are the heirs of Ninigrad and the great chiefs and warriors of the Narragansetts. Because when your ancestors stole the Negro from Africa and brought him among us and made a slave of him, we extended to him the hand of friendship and permitted his blood to be mingled with ours. Are we to be called Negroes and to be told that we may be made Negro citizens? We claim that while one drop of Indian blood remains in our veins, we are entitled to the rights and privileges guaranteed by your ancestors to ours by solemn treaty, which, without a breach of faith, you cannot violate. We did not go to the white man, but the white man came to us. When we were powerful and he was weak, he claimed our protection and we extended it. We are now weak, and our grasping neighbors of a grasping race are seeking the remaining remnant of our inheritance and will not give over while an inch of our territory remains to us and until the members of our tribe are beneath the soil or are scattered to the winds of heaven. We deny your right to take from us that which never came from you, unquote. Mm. I need them as speechwriters. The Narragansetts rejected in no uncertain terms the notion that their separate existence be terminated. They continued on to predict that if they were, their lands, held mainly by the women, would be steadily eroded by taxes, and they would be left impoverished. Furthermore, quote, your imperious draft cannot touch us now. We may volunteer to fight your battles, but now you cannot force us into the ranks of your army to be shot down without our consent, unquote. The right to vote amounted to nothing. The effort to terminate the Narragansetts similarly came to nothing at that time. 13 years later, in 1879, Rhode Island renewed their efforts to abolish the tribe. During hearings on the issues, all five Narragansett tribal council members lodged their disapproval, even though they agreed to have their school closed. Later that year, at an undocumented meeting, and for reasons that are not clear, the council agreed to sell tribal lands. This action, perhaps based on a misunderstanding of what was at stake, did not involve the full membership of the tribe. Indeed, tribal members protested the action in 1881, and a close reading of the documentary record reveals opposition during the hearings on the matter. The year before, the state of Rhode Island passed legislation, quote, which purported to abolish tribal authority and tribal relations, declared tribal members citizens, ended the state's relationship with the tribe, and which authorized the sale of all lands held in common, unquote. With this act of detribalization, which is what they called it at the time, the state of Rhode Island legislated the Narragansetts out of existence. Virtually all of the only 927 acres that remained to the tribe fell into non-Indian hands, leaving only 2 acres surrounded the Narragansett church that retained special status and have done so into the present. In effect, New England pursued termination to eliminate the claims that can be made by Indians by virtue of being nations, such as the protection of Indian homelands. Individual Indians could remain and be recognized as individual Indians, but such actions removed Indian survivors, usually cast as colored or mixed or Negro, from an Indian nationhood recognized by the state and subjected them to a narrative that insisted Indian populations were degenerate and disappearing. This brief synopsis, although not as brief as it was supposed to be, of Indian affairs in the 19th century, as Indian affairs drew to a close, cannot possibly do justice to the extraordinary complexity of the situation. This is a story that is still being reconstructed, and each tribal history contains its own crucially unique elements. But this much can be said, I think. The collective actions of state governments in the era surrounding the Civil War, steeped in the scientific racism of the 19th century, sought to terminate the separate existence of the astonishingly resilient Indian peoples of southern New England. As the eloquent synopsis supplied by the Narragansetts makes clear, as long as they retained even a drop of metaphorical Indian blood, they would defend their nationhood. So, for termination, as for so much more, Indians then, as now, had other ideas. Thank you.
And that was Jean M. O'Brien's presentation, called State Recognition and Termination in 19th Century New England. Listeners, you've been tuned in to Indigenous Politics from Native New England and Beyond with your host, Kehaulani Kawanui. Thank you for listening in. Mahalo.
Because I'm going to be so strong. Today, many of the battles that we fight are in the courtroom for our sacred right of sovereignty, surrender nation rise, Native American rights fund. I can make a change in the names of my ancestors so they didn't die in vain, but together, calling the tribes to action. One nation, can you imagine? Grandma once said our people will thrive, 500 years and we still survive. NARF, the Indian Wars never ended, the only changed venue to be continued.
Support the Native American Rights Fund. Visit NARF.org.